This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Well, it's time to talk about the Sour Castle once again. I feel like it was about 2 years ago, year and a half ago, Diane, where we kind of laid out what was going on at Sour Castle. And you know how people are. We don't remember what we did yesterday. So a year and a half ago, we sat down and talked about this mansion in KCK that was like left in disrepair, and we didn't know what was going to happen. The good news is you're kind of a getter, doer, dunner type of person around Kansas City, and you move things forward. And now all of a sudden, Kansas City may be getting themselves a nice little new treasure, huh?
Agree. Yeah. I think it was 2020, if you can believe. I think it's been that long, which is crazy. I started kind of the campaign of Sour Castle during the pandemic, which was just the right time for me to take on yet another government body. But yeah, so Sour Castle is going to be saved. It's a freaking miracle. I never thought in a million years when I took this on that it would actually happen, because it had been 25 plus 30 years ish of absolute nothing happening. So I always say that, you know, I was just talking about this with somebody the other day about historic preservation and how we all are keyboard warriors. I think we're a generation of keyboard warriors that we fight things and we think fighting via the internet is the way to go. Yeah, it's just not how it works. If you really want to take something on, you have to get to the right people. You have to get the right people together, mobilize and organize, just like I've done in the past. And it's not like I saved this place. You know, it takes a village, but it takes awareness. And I think that's what's really important.
All right. Well, let's get to kind of where we are and how we got here, because when we started talking about this a couple of years ago, it seemed like there was an owner who just wouldn't do anything, like basically wanted to own the property just to say that he owned the property, and was really like bringing the whole neighborhood down, and in turn really kind of bringing the whole city down. We're finally rid of this guy and we have new ownership of Sour Castle. So how did we get to where we are with the new owners and really getting the guy that was previously there who didn't really want to do anything? How do we get his ass to sell finally?
It's a miracle. It's a Festivus miracle, Bob Fesco. So Sour Castle built in 18. For those of you who don't know, just a little background, just to blip it out there. You can Google it. There's a ton of stuff out there. Google it with my name and you'll come up with some of the stuff I've written about it. But it was built and finished in 1873. What makes it historically significant for Kansas City, it's an Italianate villa. We don't have very many of those. We used to. We like to tear things down in Kansas City. And it was also designed by Asa Bibi Cross. And he designed Vaughn's Diamond Building. He designed the second City Hall, which was like the glorious City Hall, Gillis Opera House, the Union Depot in West Bottoms before they built Union Station. Like, he was the dude you hired if you wanted something glorious. And everything was built with character and everything we don't do today. It was amazing. And so his designs, he pretty much, I bet you he built thousands of buildings in Kansas City. And when I say built, I mean really designed, not really built. But today, there are very few standing. Wardle House is one. The Ward House off of Ward Parkway, he reconstructed that. St. Patrick's Church, the biggest one that people would recognize that's like a big version of Sour Castle, is Vail Mansion in Independence. And then there's like one structure in western Kansas that he built that survives, and everything else has been torn to the ground. So this is historically significant because we lost so much of his architecture, and he was like Kansas City's golden child. Interesting fact, I think it's his grandson actually designed the Power and Light Building. Little factoid for you. So he's in 1873, he designs this beautiful house up on a hill overlooking what now is like downtown Kansas City, really near Southwest Boulevard. It's at 935 Shawnee Road in the middle now of a subdivision. Back then, it would have been he owned the acreage around it, of course. So he died in 1879. So his reign in the house was very, very short. It was built by Anthony Sauer, and his wife stayed there, and they owned the house till 1919. She passed away. And then his oldest daughter actually lived in the house and sold it in 1954. So it stayed in the family for a long time, but then it kind of went through, you know, the ownership, they didn't do a lot. And so a couple bought the house. The Cliff and Cindy Jones and Bud Wyman bought the house in 1986, I believe. And they really wanted to restore it, but they just didn't have the funds. I mean, this place would take money to really make it beautiful. To be clear, though, it was still habitable. You could still go inside and not like worry the floor was going to fall down or fall underneath you. And so they sold it in 1988 to the great-great-grandson of Anthony Sauer. So back to the family, they thought that would be great. Well, it turned out to be a living hell. So he has owned it since 1988 and it literally did pretty much nothing for all of these years. Like we're talking, he said, hey, I replaced the electrical. No, you didn't. Now I can tell you he hasn't because I've been in there. I replaced the plumbing. No, you didn't. Like, this place is a shell of what it was before. And to be clear too, he lived in New York City. The prior owner lived in New York City. And so he had caretakers on the property. He also owned the house next door, which was also a family's property. So he would come in town and stay at the house next door and then say he was working on Sauer Castle. The government even threatened to take it through eminent domain. I mean, like, this was like, people would have been concerned about this. And can you imagine being a neighbor and watching this place fall to pieces? Not good. And of course, the more dilapidated something becomes, and it already looks kind of like a creepy castle, the more ghost stories come up. So people try vandalizing the property. And that happened in the 1990s. A caretaker and a friend, so somebody that the owner at the time trusted, went in and stole $30,000 worth of antique chandeliers, everything that made that mantles, everything that makes Sauer Castle beautiful got stripped from that place. And of course he's like, I'll fix it. It never happened. So I had, you know, I guess the pandemic made me maybe a little bored, maybe thought I was a little bit of a keyboard warrior, but I did actually physically talk to people. I wanted to figure out what was taking so long to get this property out of this guy's hands. Why wouldn't he sell? And at the point when I got involved, there were over a dozen property violations. And one of the things that this owner did was that he would play the tax game. So he wouldn't pay his taxes ever. So 3 years would come up, it would end up on the auction list. And of course, everybody who wants to save it is trying to, you know, log in and to buy it. And at the last second, he would pay the minimum amount due, never pay the full amount, minimum amount due. And then he'd make a payment arrangement with Wyandotte County. And then he'd renege on the payment deal. And this went on for 20 years, every 3 years. I mean, you have to wonder what the government was thinking, right?
So why would Wyandotte County let him get away with such a scam like that? I can see one time you say, okay, I can't afford my taxes, I'm going to set up a plan. But when it becomes habitual and you're doing it for almost an entire generation, this mm-hmm. is where I look at Wyandotte County and I go, pull your head out, man. This guy's clearly not going to pay his taxes, but I'm sure there's some stupid law on the books that says as long as he gives you 2 cents, you can't take it away from him and you're just going to charge him back interest, money that most likely you're never going to get unless he sells the house and you have liens on this thing. And so I guess, you know, Wyandotte yeah. County figured they'd get the money at the end. But eventually somebody should have wised up over there in the unified government and went, okay, hang on a second here. This guy's not paying his property taxes. This thing is going to decay. And it's not only affecting Sauer Castle, but it's bringing down everything else in the area. And that's where you need yep. to step in as a government and fight for the rest of the residents that are there.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. That was one of the biggest things that really, I think, would really irk the neighborhood. So I didn't just talk to...
Is Frank White working over there too?
No kidding. Yeah, seriously. He's like, oh, I'm going to dabble on this side too. See where we can put a stadium over here. Yeah, you're 100% correct. I asked the same questions. And to be fair, they do have to go by the law. And the law changed during this whole shenanigans. One of the things that changed was that eminent domain in the state of Kansas could not be used under certain purposes anymore. So when I had to learn case law, I was like, this is annoying. So one of the things that they couldn't take the property and without it had, there were ways to do it. I want to be clear. There were ways to do it. We got creative there at the end. There were ways to do it, but it had to be strategic. The mayor at the time, which was David Alvey, I had talked to him and I'm like, and he was just as concerned, you know. I talked to him and I was just trying to figure out what was the end goal here for them. They're like, we're doing everything we can. What really made me angry is how angry the neighborhood was, like you were saying, because you can imagine being a taxpayer in UG, right? In the Unified Government of Wyandotte County, you're a taxpayer and their taxes are pretty high over there, believe it or not. And their tax base is pissed because they're watching this place crumble that is taking their property values down. They're watching this place crumble. He's getting away with it. And then they're getting cited for chipped paint on their house. Could you imagine? Like, are you kidding me? So it was a real contentious thing going on. And it really had to do with the law, but they really picked up. It depends. And here's the problem. When you play the game for as long as he did, their judges have changed. The leadership has changed. The mayor changes. So it was like a new set of people, you know, even the councilmen, you know, over there, like everything changed, which gave him an advantage because he kind of started over with judges. He would make an arrangement with one and then they'd be on the bench for maybe 5 years and they disappear. Next one comes up. He kind of knows what's going on. And there were judges that try to keep him accountable. But they were working and they would say, we won't take it from you if you make repairs on the house. And this was one of the interesting things I learned. So he said, I'll come up with a plan, because at this point they were going to literally take it from him in the 90s. And so in 2000, he hired A.L. Huber Construction, which happens to be a really good friend of mine. Little did the owner know. And so he hired them to contract out the work. And he was really concerned about like the dumbest stuff, like putting a fence up around the property. They're like, how about the fact the floors are falling in? He's like, fence first. You know, his ideas of what he thought were important were just ridiculous. So they started work, but you have to get paid. Yeah. You know? And he didn't like to pay his bills. He had a definite, you know, definitely wasn't doing that with the government, wasn't doing that with contractors. And so Huber actually walked off the job. So he would do enough to appease the government, and then it would take him a long time to catch up. But what was happening during the pandemic is that the right people were watching this like a hawk. And so by the time I was writing about it and I was keeping up with what was happening on the property with the help of some friends, neighbors, people who I knew, they were like, hey, this is going on over there. I'm like, let me see what I can find out. And so in the end, he had 28 property violations, totaling over like $30,000. Like, it was insane. And they had to board up the structure to secure it for the winter. The tower on the west side, there's a four-story tower. Okay. It's a widow's peak. It's amazing. And one day I get a phone call. We had a bunch of rain in 2021 in the summertime. And it, of course, you know, it hadn't rained in forever. So the ground was hard and whatnot. And so this rain came down at like buckets. And all of a sudden I get a call, Diane, the front porch just collapsed. I'm like, what are you talking about? So I'm like, yeah. So I get in my car and I drive out there, and I did a Facebook Live actually. I'm like, well, how did this happen? Well, I mean, it was already falling down, but it turns out, little investigation, that the West Side Towers bricks were falling down and that's what caused the front porch to collapse, was bricks falling from the tower. So now it's a gaping hole in the tower and nothing was being done. And so it's like one winter comes up and it's like, ah, like literally exposed to the elements, four stories up on, by the way, the highest hill in Wyandotte County. Like, this isn't good. So I thought for sure the owner had told me, I'm not selling. Then he listed it since we talked last. He listed it. He said, I'm not selling. Okay, I'll put it on the market. There must have been some reason, like legally, that he did this. I'll put it on the market for $10 million. $10 million. Bob, you got $10 mil for place?
Not sitting around, but I'm trying to think as you know, you tell the story, Diane, about, you know, the MO here, like why this guy bought it when he did and what he was trying to do. Clearly, he bought it to keep it in the family. He saw a way to get this kind of namesake, I believe, back in his family. And then, like most of us, realize I'm probably a little bit overextended here. In fact, maybe I'm a lot overextended here and I can't afford this. But man, this house has meant so much to my family. I don't want to give it up. I don't want to be looked at as the guy who failed and lost this house again. And so I think you get, and this is, again, this is just me perceiving how I'm viewing all this. It sounds like there was a big ego involved and this guy bit off more than he could chew and really didn't know how to get out of it without maybe embarrassing himself too, you know?
Yeah, maybe, maybe. But he did have the money. I mean, he had the money. Mm-hmm. He just didn't want to. I think he's just one of those people, you know, a lot of people that have money don't want to spend it. So, you have to, if you're going to own a historic property, you have to know that you're going to have one issue after the next that's going to happen. And I'm not even talking cosmetic. I'm talking like the nuts and bolts of a house. And so when he listed it for $10 million, I was like, this is insane. So I ended up back on TV again, talking about this $10 million price tag. It's hard not to laugh at that. I mean, it just really hard. It's like, do you want the Wyandotte County to assess you for $10 million? Because they will, mm-hmm. you know, that would not be good. So I thought for sure it was a dead deal and it was upsetting. So I just figured the more I wrote about it and the more I kept awareness out there that maybe there'd be a miracle that would happen. And I just, you know, I lost hope. I'd never been inside the house. I'd been on the outside of the house. First journalist in 30 years to actually get on the property, which was a miracle right there. But I was also lectured about how wrong I was about my writing, which I was not wrong, by the way. I 100% corrected what I said, and I stand by it to this day. You know, I was wrong that the house was falling down, and look at how beautiful the bricks are. And oh boy, what do I know now? Because it's not true. But in any case, I thought it was a dead deal. And then out of nowhere, all of a sudden, I get a phone call like, Diane, the property has been sold. I'm like, there is no way. I didn't believe it. And this was March of 2023. And I said, there's no way. No way he sold. $10 million price tag. I know we didn't sell for that. So in any case, a local businessman with a background in construction, to be clear, a local businessman named Mike Heitman had been talking to Carl, the prior owner, for many months. And convinced him to sell it to him and the house next door and some of the property surrounding it. And I was like, who is this guy? Of course, immediately I'm like, wait, who is he? What do we know about him? And I did some research. And then when I found out he was in the construction field, I totally did a little, you know, digging with my friends locally. Like, what do we know about him? Is he good? Is he going to, you know, he's not going to tear this place down, is he? You know, I mean, I didn't know. And, you know, I was told he was a good guy and he had restored a home in the past. And I mean, I never thought in a million years this would happen. Now, I stayed kind of off the radar a little bit. I just, you know, I had let people know that we're in contact with him. If he had any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them. And he did actually contact me a few months ago. And it was an interesting conversation. His question, he does not want to be in the limelight. And I think that's a really interesting and a hard dynamic in this situation because the house is in the limelight and you're doing like people watch all of a sudden there's all this expensive scaffolding all outside of the house. So like people are like, oh my God, he's actually doing stuff. Like we love him, but we don't know anything about him. Who is he? And of course the news wants to know about him. And I'm like, well, he's pretty private, it appears. So, and I get it, you know, like some people don't want to be in front of a camera. It's not exactly my favorite thing either, but I'll do it if I have to, right? So he contacted me and he said, I am interested in keeping people interested. I want people to feel like they're part of this renovation, but I don't want anything to do with it. Like, I'm working with the he's hired like a dream team of people. He's got Roast and Preservation working on all the paperwork to make sure everything is done by national, like by standards. He has one of the best architects in the city who, well, I even say the Midwest for historic preservation. She's amazing. It's a woman. She's great. And then they have Pishney Construction, Pishney Restoration doing all of the trade stuff. So like all of the details and all the bricks and all the stuff that I don't know anything about. So he's hired this dream team and everybody's watching this happen, but he's not talking about it. And he knew that was a problem. And he's like, I know you were in front of the camera. What can I do to get people, you know, have them stay connected? And I was like, well, if you don't want to be in front of the camera, that's a problem, because you are like, you can't have, imagine an HGTV series where a guy, you know, you can't have it without the owner. I mean, you just can't. And so I was like, I don't know. I was like, let me think about it. And so I got back to him and I gave him some different ideas, and including like contact KU, maybe film. And I was like, you could, you know, I was like, that would take a while to get projects approved. And I was like, you know, I actually teach. I happen to be a historian who teaches Kansas City history, who also happens to teach broadcast journalism at Grandview High School. And I have a student that's interested in doing film for a career. And I have a student who's interested in being a broadcast journalist who needs to learn better film techniques. Like, she's great in front of a camera, but she needs to learn the behind the scenes stuff. And I was like, we could probably whip some videos out. He's like, great, let's do that. I'm like, oh, okay. What? I was like, what did I just get myself into? So I talked to my students and they were like, this is cool. Sure. And I had to talk to the parents, like, they're going to be at a construction site. They're like, cool. And I was like, let's do this. So, yeah, we dropped our first video.
So you guys are documenting this. Before we get to like the stuff that you've been able to see and what's been going on so far, tell me more about what this guy wants to accomplish, because we're not talking about something that is in, you know, an area where tourists are going or even locals are going. I mean, if you don't live on that street, there's really no reason for you to go up there. I mean, just kind of like any street, right? It just happens to be this old historic home on this big plot of land that has a great view. And, you know, obviously when it's renovated, it's going to be awesome and do great things for that neighborhood. But like, what does this guy spend all this money on this mansion for? Like, what's he hoping to accomplish with this? Because to me, it looks like the perfect like wedding venue. You get married out in the field, you spend the night there, you know, you could do your rehearsal dinner there if you wanted, you could do your reception there. Like, it's got a lot of potential. What are we looking at? What's the end game for him?
There's been a lot of, you know, I know that even when I was involved with trying to save it, we worked with the Kansas City Design Center on some ideas of what to do with the property. Like, it used to be have a vineyard on it. I'm like, let's do that again. That'd be cool. And you can actually still see the tiering where the vineyard was. It's like, I can even still, there might be grapes still out there. We got to go look. You know, and then he was really big into horticulture. So maybe you do some type of like flowers that you could like as a community garden. And then, like you said, it's a perfect wedding venue. You can't have, you know, thousands of people out there. It's not that big of a house, really. But you certainly could do stuff on site because the grounds are large. So I think when he first purchased it, his goal, he likes a challenge. If you meet him, he's in it for the right reason. I mean, 100% in it, more so than I would even. I feel like he even has more of a wholesome perspective than I do on this. Like, I wanted it saved and I'm thrilled, but like, he's like, I want to give this back to the community. And it's unbelievable, because this is not cheap, you know, and this is a personally financed project. I think, you know, he had toyed around with, you know, maybe moving in there, and he toyed around with, this is what I know for a fact at this point. In order for something for plans to get approved, because you don't just, it's not like it's the plans where you go down to City Hall and they stamp it and they say, here's your permit. This is a historic landmark. So you have to make sure you're going through you got to dot the I's, cross the T's and all of that. So he has to come up with the design team he has to come up with a plan for the long term. So he has to decide soon what it is going to be, because that has to be on paper somewhere. And I believe at this point that it looks like he wants it to be some type of venue and space for the public. So at this point, it's turning into being something. I think he told Fox 4 when I did this interview. And again, he didn't want to be on camera, but he did respond, I think, to an email or something, that he wanted it to be something that would be for the community, maybe have concerts there, et cetera, et cetera. So I can't give you exact details about what that looks like yet. But I'm certainly going to know pretty soon because we're documenting this like monthly.
But, so what have you guys been able to kind of uncover when you've been going through it? I know you said you put out that first video. I've watched a little of that you sent me. I saw some of the video on Fox 4 of what this thing looks like inside. It's very intriguing, I'm going to say. Like I am like, wow, the fact that he can get this done as quickly as you think he can get it done is awesome. But like, what have you guys been able to kind of uncover? And I'm sure the kids are getting a great education, you know, almost better than being in the classroom at this point.
Oh, this is a big deal. I told the students this. I've also said, even for me, we talked about this a little bit earlier. This is beyond my understanding. I'm all about historic preservation, but I am not a preservationist, meaning I don't know how tuck pointing works. I don't know what you have to do to make sure the dormers are secure. I don't know. That's why you hire the people that he's hired. So what I've learned so far, and the architect has been Strata Architecture, Angie, she like has been amazing in explaining what, because our next episode is about securing the exterior of the property. So we did like the first one that, and you can go to Saving Sour Castle on YouTube and see the video, is about the history of the property and then how it got to where we are today. And so we had already filmed the interviews with the different tradesmen. So I'm like filming on the fourth story tower. Oh, you know, on the scaffolding, filming the guy who's laying brick. It's like, what's happening? I am HGTV. But so the students are right there with me. One of the things that is really interesting that I think that people would be probably the most intrigued by is that it is very clear now that they've taken out some of the, not the walls, but some of the plaster had been falling anyway. When you look at the interior staircase, the main staircase, it is 100% clear that Asa Bibi Cross's original design was not executed. And here's how we know, is that one of the doors, there was originally a door on the first floor that was a large entry that had been bricked up. So what had happened is, as they were doing the construction, I'm guessing Mary Sauer, the wife, went, no, I want this. And they changed the interior design while it was being built, which is really interesting. And so when you get to like the second floor, and remember, there's a four-story walk-up, and really the last story, as I learned when I got to go up to the Widow's Peak, and that was scary and amazing, is that the last portion is a ladder. So that's fun. But what I learned is that on that, kind of going from the first floor to the second, there's like a landing area. And like, you can tell that it wasn't originally supposed to be there because the window peeks out on the top. So like, it's cut off. So it's like this little itty bitty, like, arched window that really should be fully on the first floor. So somebody changed the design, which is just unbelievable. So as you're looking, when you're looking at this from a perspective of how design happened, and we were so proud of the fact, the architect and I were talking about this. This is Asa Bibi Cross's design, but we think, and again, it's our summation here, is that he put the plans on paper and then somebody built it, right? And as it was being built, they changed things. So it's like kind of weird thinking, and they kind of cut some corners in some places. And that could have been, you know, money shortage. It could have been, and I don't mean cut corners like in a bad way. Just like one of the things that I noticed too, when we'll talk about this a little bit, I think in the second episode, is that on the door, like on the closet doors, if you look at them closely, it looks like wood graining. It's painted on to make it look even more grainy. There was an artist, and there's even a spot on another floor where you can see where they practiced. It's like, this was 1873, and this crap, the stuff that you're finding is just like, who knew? I mean, just it. So just details like that. Now, our next episode is really about the, like I said, the exterior, like how they're securing it. And another thing I learned is that when the prior owner, I try not to use his name very often, when the prior owner was so proud of that tuck pointing that he did and the brick work he had done, when the front porch fell off, it exposed the original brick behind it, right? And you can see how smooth that brick was and then how rough the brick is on the outside. He basically, what happened is that the people who were hired sandblasted the castle. And, you know, if you look at bricks and if you know anything about bricks, which I learned a lot about bricks from the people at Sour Castle working on it, is that bricks are hard on the exterior, but they're soft on the interior. So if you get rid of the exterior, what happens to the bricks? They become porous. What happens when they become porous? They fall from, like, maybe, I don't know, the west side of the tower. I mean, unbelievable. It's crazy.
She's Diane Houston. She gets things done. If you got an abandoned house in your neighborhood, give her a call. She will definitely take care of it and make it into, maybe, who knows, another historic landmark.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Oh, oh,
oh, O'Reilly. Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Oh, 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 O'Reilly.